Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 71. Zena?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 71 eliminates the requirement under the prescription drug monitoring program that pharmacies must report to the Oregon Health Authority within 1 week of dispensing a prescription drug. There is a -1 amendment which requires pharmacies to report to the Oregon Health Authority no later than 72 hours. There is no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact.
Okay. We are in work session. I need the -1 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 71.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 71. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Excused.
Aye.
Motion carries, and
Madam Chair, I move yes. Senate Bill 71 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Yes, I meant to say adopted. The amendment was adopted. Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 71 as adopted to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry the bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 71, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 145. Sina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 145 defines a small employer as the term used in federal law. There is a -2 amendment which defines small employer as an average of at least one but not more than 50 employees. There's no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact.
And I believe that there is no opposition to the -2 amendments. And so, Steiner Hayward.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 145.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves the -2 amendments into Senate Bill 145. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 145 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves Senate Bill 145 as adopted with the -2 amendments into Senate Bill 145. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 What is it?
Just say yes.
Just say yes.
Just say yes.
Senate Bill 145.
145,
oh.
Definition.
Aye. I need to know what bill it is for a vote.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will carry the bill. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 145, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 606. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 606 appropriates money to the Oregon Health Authority for extending dental pilot projects. It extends dental pilot projects until 2023. There's a -1 amendment which restores language and statute to operate dental pilot projects for 3 to 5 years and extends the sunset to 2025. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued, and there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 606.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments into Senate Bill 606. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 606 as amended by the -1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 606 with the -1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. It's on its way. And I would like to make sure that I get people who live more than 100 miles away. And so hopefully on the sheet you mark down whether you live more than 100 miles, and we're going to start with 523, but if we get too late and I'm thinking that we're not going to have enough time, I'm going to be calling up those people on the other bills that live further away. Okay, with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 523. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 523 specifies provisions for qualified health plans to notify health care providers when enrollees fail to pay premiums during the grace period. It requires the insurer that terminates coverage during the grace period to reimburse the provider for services if the insurer fails to notify the provider that enrollee is in the grace period or provider has contracted with the insurer and services covered by the plan. There's a dash two amendment which adds that if an insurer terminates coverage due to non-payment by the enrollee, the insurer must pay the claim for reimbursement if the service was provided during the first month of the grace period. There's a dash three amendment that requires if the insurer terminates coverage due to non-payment by enrollee, the insurer must pay a claim for reimbursement. There's no revenue impact and there may be a fiscal impact, but statements have not been issued.
All right. Deborah Bartel, Courtney Dresser, Sarah Basler.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Deborah Bartel, and I'm testifying today as a member of the Legislative Committee on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association in support of Senate Bill 523. I'm also a clinic administrator at Portland Diabetes and Endocrinology Center in Portland, Oregon. For the past several years, it's been my pleasure to assist in many of the successfully implemented healthcare administrative simplification initiatives here in Oregon, as well as some still in progress. As a patient advocate, I'm intimately familiar with the daily business practices of a medical clinic and the impact insurance coverage has on our patients, many of whom are chronically ill. We verify each patient's health insurance status shortly before each visit, ideally using compliant electronic transactions with their insurance payer. It allows us to quickly identify issues and spend less staff time resolving them before the patient actually arrives. If these transactions are not available, we attempt to verify using provider portals or actually calling the insurance companies on the phone. Currently, none of these three options let us know when the patient has entered the 90-day grace period for non-payment of insurance premium. Non-payment of insurance premium is not a new problem in our industry, but previously, if we billed an insurance claim for services and our patient's individual or group premium hadn't been paid, the payer would send us notification without payment, letting us know that the payment was pending receipt of premium. Insurance plans purchased via an Accountable Care Act health insurance exchange actually fall under a different set of rules. They require insurance companies to promptly pay claims, and on the surface, it seems to alleviate the problem that providers sometimes have with delay of payment. However, by not letting us know that this money might be requested to be returned, we don't have the opportunity to counsel our patients on the importance of keeping their insurance premiums up to date and also work with them on a potential payment plan or help them try and resolve the problem if their situation has changed and maybe they can't afford their insurance premiums anymore. So we are just asking to have notification when the insurance plans know that the patient's fallen into that grace period so that we can maybe help the patients understand their benefits a little bit better and why it's important. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Let's have the panel first.
Chair Vanessa Anderson, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and we brought this bill forward after our provider started to let us know that this might be a problem. Currently, as you were just heard, there is a 90-day grace period for patients who receive a subsidized plan through the health insurance exchange. And the issues around the rulemaking at CMS are pretty vague on the provider side about when they're going to get notified of the patient being in that grace period. So this bill does that. It provides the timely notification to the provider that their patient is in the grace period under whatever day they are in, which allows our providers to talk to the patients and make better healthcare decisions. It ensures continuity of care for a patient who begins treatment prior to entering the grace period, so that treatment can continue. So chemotherapy or something like that could continue even if they're in the grace period. And we also require DCBS to help us with some consumer education material, so providers can counsel their patients on paying premiums and the importance of it. That is with the Dash 2 amendments.
which we would request that if you move the bill forward, that the dash 2 be adopted. The dash 3 is a very clear amendment that states all of the claims within those 90 days. Currently, only the first 30 days have to be covered by the insurance exchange or the qualified health plan, that all 90 days would be covered by that qualified health plan. So that's obviously the one we would like to see adopted, but we understand that you might not want to move that far. So dash 2 or the dash 3s, and that's what they do, and we can explain further if you have any more questions.
Sarah Basler, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. Sarah Basler on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association, also in support of Senate Bill 523 and its proposed amendments. You've already heard about the problem with the 90-day grace period where the insurers have to reimburse claims for the first 30 days. The federal law is silent on the second 60 days of that grace period, and so in practical terms, it means the provider and ultimately the patient are responsible for payment for claims during that time period. Because there isn't necessarily prompt notification to the provider frequently misses an opportunity to discuss the patient's coverage with the patient when the patient is in the office. You've already heard from the other panelists about the importance of that and the impact that that can have on helping come up with a payment plan or letting a patient know about other options that might be out there to assist if needed. We work with several hundred nurse practitioners throughout the state, many of whom are small business owners. They struggle with the same administrative burdens that you've heard from other practices frequently in this committee. And currently, when they call an insurer to verify a patient's coverage prior to a visit, when a patient falls into this grace period, they may only hear that, yes, the patient is covered without a mention of the grace period. So in that scenario, a provider could expect that the claim would be reimbursed by the insurer. They bill the insurer only then to find out that actually the patient was in day 45 of a grace period, and therefore they're not required to be reimbursed. So we think transparency is obviously a really important part of this. It can help providers anticipate what's coming. Also, the Dash 3 amendment is a much simpler solution that would reduce the need for some of the nuanced communication around the grace period that's envisioned in the Dash 2 amendment and the underlying bill. So we would urge your support of Senate Bill 523 as well as the Dash 3 amendment. Thank you.
Questions? I think we're brain dead from floor session.
Doesn't mean we don't think it's important.
No.
All right. Thank you very much, panel. BJ Kavner, Tom Holt, and Jessica Adamson. The sad BJ go first, if he's here.
No, he's not here right now.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. Unfortunately, I'm here with concerns about Senate Bill 523, in particular the Dash 3 amendment. Providence Health Plan in our provider portal, so when a provider goes online to check and verify patient eligibility, we do on the first day of the second month, that's the after that initial 30-day grace period, we do flag that a patient is within the grace period and has not yet paid. And so while we understand the issue that the proponents are trying to fix, and we are sympathetic to that issue as providers, we would like to work with the proponents to make sure that the language in that bill would not require us to do more than what's already there. If a provider is logging on to check eligibility, which is how that happens on a kind of day-to-day basis, it flags that there, and we want to make sure that that is considered sufficient notice. The language of the bill as it's written would require us to provide notice at every claim filing. That seems to us perhaps even unhelpful because that's already after the fact. Requiring an expansion of coverage is also unhelpful. We think it's pretty important that patients and that members start paying their premiums. We want to make sure that that's happening. We absolutely support having our providers help in that conversation with patients that have not yet paid their premiums. And we certainly want to be thoughtful about any communication from DCBS, because what we don't want to create is an unintended consequence where patients all of a sudden figure out, well, I can get free healthcare for 3 months, and then I can dump my current plan and go get a different one and restart the clock. We certainly don't want that unintended consequence. No one wants to see that happen. So we want to make sure that our members are paying their bills. We want to make sure that our providers are getting paid. We don't want there to be any surprises, but we are concerned about the current way the bill is drafted, but more than happy to work with the proponents to try and narrow the scope.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Cambia Health Solutions. We, too, are very concerned about the way the bill is structured. Just take a moment and just explain what we currently do. One, the information is made available on our portals if someone is in that grace period. But then also in those really, frankly, rare instances from what we see so far, that a claim comes through for someone who is not current in their premium, within 24 hours, we make an outbound call to the provider to make sure that they are aware of that, and then they can make decisions about whether or not they're ordering treatments that potentially can be scheduled at another time without any risk to the patient. So we're trying to work with the providers on that. As the bill is written, and particularly the -3 amendments, it would detach any connection to whether the person is actually enrolled or using an in-network provider, and it essentially would relieve the provider from, in effect, any responsibility to check eligibility, because we'd be paying whether they check or not, and we don't think that's fair. We don't want providers to be left hanging. Frankly, we didn't think it was terrific policy to have the grace period structured the way they are in the ACA, but they are what they are. That's why we have in the exchange plans in Oregon, people do have to pay the first month of premium before they're enrolled in a plan. It's because I think everyone, provider and payer alike, pushed back and said, hey, wait a minute. This whole arrangement only works if everybody is actually in the pool and participating and paying their bill for coverage. So we would like the opportunity to see if we can come to agreement on some language that works. But this is a balance. And as was noted by the proponents, this is to some degree, while there's a unique situation with the ACA, people not being on time with their premiums is not anything new. We see it all the time. Most of the time, people eventually pay within their grace period after they get a communication reminding them that they need to do that. I think there's a question of to what extent this really exists, and we'd like to be able to work on a language that really targets the problem.
All right. Questions?
Quick
yes.
Question. So to both of you, if a provider or their staff call, you're telling me that you tell them whether or not the person is in the grace period. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Shields, that is what we do.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I can tell you for sure that I know that in the patient portal, it's an online portal, that we flag that. I don't know about phone calls. I did not ask that question. Let me find out, and I'll get back to you.
Okay, what I would like to have done is you and OMA, ONA, see if you can get together on the language of -2, and it sounds like -3 is going to be a problem, but see if there can be good language on the -3s, and we will post this for a work session for the next 2 weeks. So get your act together really quick, and we'll see what we can do.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 523 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 905. Zena.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 905 adds a physician assistant to the Oregon Medical Board. It allows the physician assistant to be selected by the governor from a list of 3 to 5 candidates submitted by the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. There is a dash one amendment which permits physician assistant to be retired and appoints candidates for the year the term expires. It repeals the physician assistant committee.
Okay, we only have two people, Aaron Kramer and Elizabeth Remley.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I am Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. We want to thank the entire committee for being sponsors of this bill. Senate Bill 905 does a couple things. It adds a physician assistant to the Oregon Medical Board. Currently, PAs, while they are licensed by the Oregon Medical Board, do not have a seat on the committee or on the board. And we have had a long-standing goal of changing that. This session has presented itself as an opportunity, especially with the a conversation around Senate Bill 279, which would put Oregon Medical Board into the status of semi-independent agency. We felt that it was important to start having a physician assistant have representation on the board. So the bill really quickly does just a couple of things. It adds a PA to the board. It abolishes the Physician Assistant Committee, which is an advisory committee currently made up of three PAs and a physician who's also a member of the medical board that provides non-binding recommendations to the board. And as we add a PA to the board, we won't need that advisory committee to serve in its role anymore. And the third thing it does is it cleans up some language around the terms of the board members. This is language we worked on with the medical board. We discovered some discrepancies in term language as far as when board members should be put forth and how long their terms are. And we're just, it's technical cleanup language that we worked with the medical board on. So with that, I'll let Aaron do the talking.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Aaron Kramer. I'm the governmental affairs chair of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and I'm a practicing PA. I work in a primary care clinic in Sublimity, which is about 15 miles east of here. Thank you very much for your sponsorship of Senate Bill 905. I've submitted some written testimony. It also offers a detailed information and background on 905. I think it's worth noting that physician assistants are a very fast-growing medical field in the state. Only 8 years ago, there were only half as many as there are now. There were 700 of us, and now there are more than 1,500. I anticipate those numbers will grow quickly as we move to fill the need for primary care in the state, as well as other providers do. It makes sense that PAs are licensed by the OMB, given that we are trained in the medical model as physicians are, and that we work alongside them in collaboration and as practice partners with physicians. For several decades, the OMB has received their advisory input from the PAC, the Physician Assistant Committee, and they reviewed and approved all license applications for PAs until 2011, when the legislature passed Senate Bill 224 to modernize that licensing procedure. Since then, their role has changed to become, in our view, truly advisory. I want to be clear that we, the OSPA, appreciates the work that the PAs who have served on the advisory committee have done. They do a great service to the profession and the public, and we in no way impugn them. But we do feel that it's time that the OMB's membership include a physician assistant. As we are a practice partner, we should also be a partner in regulation and in oversight and serving the public. I also understand that the timing of this bill is somewhat sensitive. Why do Senate Bill 905 this session? I think that we've been waiting for the right time, and with the OMB's impending semi-independence move through Senate Bill 279, this is the right time. We can continue to work again with our partners in practice to be partners in oversight. With the rapid growth of the profession and the modernization of the statutes, it feels like the best fit is to have a PA on the board of their licensing agency rather than represented by the non-binding recommendations of an advisory committee. I ask for your support in Senate Bill 905, and thank you for your time.
Great. No questions.
Thanks, Senator.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 905 and another one that's a quick bill, and then we'll get to 920. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 648.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 648 adds four members to the Central Oregon Health Council. It permits the council to convene a single community advisory council for all coordinated care organizations that join. It requires a regional health improvement plan to include community health assessments and community health improvement plan. It extends the sunset to 2022. There is no amendment, and there's no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact.
Great. All right. Commissioner Tammy Bainey, Lindsay Hopper, Mike Shercliffe, and Robin, you'll clean up. Okay. And we like the bill at this point. There's no opposition, so let's it brief.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, at one time late in the session when we were in the House, I told a room full of folks, I gave them a choice of either testifying on the bill or passing the bill.
Very good. We will be brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my senator friend and sponsor of this bill, Senator Tim Canope, great to see you. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tammy Bainey. I'm a Deschutes County Commissioner, but I'm also here wearing the hat of the Central Oregon Health Council, of which I am chair. I'm sure that you're wondering why would this be necessary with the onset of CCOs, so we will be brief, but also point out a few of the reasons why this is needed. We essentially, and I won't go through it too much, but were the petri dish to how CCOs began. And regardless of the success statewide, we wanted to remain committed to aligning our region in a way that moved beyond just medical care reform and really supported public health and the public health principles within our communities that help us get to healthy communities, not just medical payment reform. As you all know this, the story of CCOs, but Senate Bill 648 allows us to continue our unique partnership in our community, and we believe that it sets our region apart from others. Through our original guiding legislation, which is Senate Bill 204, our counties are allowed to work regionally, and that means that we are able to look at our region in a way that does not differentiate between Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson, and allows us to reach beyond. Some people live in one county and work in another, and vice versa, and we want to be able to make sure that we meet those needs across those boundaries. So Senate Bill 204 sunsetting, Bill 648 allows us to continue to do regional planning, which is one of the tenets of our opportunities afforded to us in 204. So that does not by any means say that our intent is continue and support the elements and requirements by the Oregon Health Authority, but it does allow us to do that in a regional fashion versus just county by county. So I think one of the big tenets is in a 10-year period, we were submitting 66 plans to the state of Oregon. This allows us to do that planning collectively, and it's also allows us to some administrative reprieve. So you will hear today from a few others outlining our success. Our membership is one that we are proud of because you have our governance structure. The community member who is a foster mom out of the Madras area has the exact same vote weight as the CEO of our hospital, and we think that's pretty cool. We also align ourselves very closely to the Oregon public meetings laws so that we have transparency as well. And with that and our approach, we hope that you will be supportive of Senate Bill 648. And if you have any questions, I'll answer those at the end.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Lindsay Hopper. I'm the Executive Director of the Central Oregon Health Council. I don't want to repeat what Tammy said, so I thought I'd lead into some aspects of our governance and partnership that make our system unique and part of why Senate Bill 648 is important to the work of the Health Council. Because the community and our partners trust the Health Council as a neutral third-party convener, they're willing to engage in open dialogue and share information that might otherwise be held closely. This is not a model that can be forced on people, but it's one that's grown locally in Central Oregon since 2009. This information sharing and dialogue makes our collective pursuit of the Triple Aim possible and community-driven. We trust each other and hold board meetings with public comment, questions, and answers. We distributed transformation funds and self-tax dollars for projects in the region where those funds can best serve our communities. And lastly, for the first time ever, this summer, we will distribute shared savings through our community governance model. These funds will help support quality initiatives in the community and fund our collective work to implement our regional health improvement plan. We're excited by the opportunity, and I'll answer any questions at the end. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mike Shercliffe, and I'm actually here in kind of a little different role than usual. I'm a dentist, and I'm the president of Advantage Dental. I actually serve on the Health Council and Central Oregon Health Council. I'm the vice chair, and have a unique perspective on it because my my company is in all 16 CCOs, and so we get an opportunity to see the flavor of all the governance models that there are and how they work. And I have to tell you, it's uniquely refreshing to be in Central Oregon because it's probably the most transparent of all the ones that we're in. And it's they all have their unique qualities, and I'm not here to say anything bad about any of them. It's just some are different than others. I like Central Oregon Health Council because it allows us to. It's a little more cumbersome. But it allows us to be able to debate things and do things in a way that are pretty open and really like working. The other thing it does, and there's some other bills circling around the building that that are dealing with this, is that it gets a DCO representative on the governing board, which I think if we're going to integrate oral health, physical health, and mental health, that everybody needs to be around the table. And I appreciate the opportunity in Central Oregon to be able to sit in at the table and really transforming healthcare. Thank you very much. My testimony is written, and I'll not belabor you with that because you have an opportunity to look at that another time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Robin Henderson from St. Charles Health System. You may also know me as the original executive director of the Central Oregon Health Council, who graciously and gratefully passed this over to the very competent and capable Lindsay Hopper in July of 2013. What I wanted to bring you was the support of St. Charles Health System, the health system that is part of the CCO, where, as Commissioner Bainey said, our CEO, who runs the billion-dollar company, has the same vote as the mom from Madras. And that's very important to us. And there's three little points I want to make for you. The public-private partnership does just what Dr. Shercliffe said, transparency. Every meeting of the Health Council is open. Everything's transparent. That doesn't happen anywhere else in Oregon. And nothing bad has happened because of transparency. In fact, it's a good thing. Second thing is the joint management agreement, which creates accountability between the CCO and all of the partners, which means that the money that she talked about in the shared reinvestment, that didn't go back into anybody's pocket. That money did what you intended it to do. It's going back into our community very transparently, and it's not a small chunk of change anyway. And the last thing is the community approach to a plan. It is not lost on me what the Regional Health Improvement Plan does, because as a hospital system, we also have requirements for a CHA and a CHIP for a community health assessment and community health improvement plan. And our CEO, Joe Sluka, says that what our eventual goal is to align our mission with that of the Health Council and to align our plan with that of the Health Council. And for a health system to say that is quite remarkable. Thank you for your consideration of this, and we certainly hope that this can move forward today.
Only one question from me. Do you know any opposition from other CCOs saying, how come you get to do this and I can't, or anything like that? Or I guess they could. Yeah.
I do have a question. Is St. Charles involved in any other CCOs?
No, we are not.
It's interesting. Yeah. Well, all the A's and B's feed to you, which is why I asked the question. So, okay.
Okay. All right. With that, no question, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 648 and open a work session on Senate Bill 648.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 6. There's no amendments, is there? No, thank you. Is there?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 648 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 648 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Excused.
Oh, wait, just a minute. He's coming in.
Just say yes, Chip. It'll be fine.
What are we voting on?
On 648, the Oregon Health Council.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Senator Canope will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 648. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 920. Zena.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 920 declares findings on antibiotic resistance in industrial farms. It prohibits livestock producers from providing medically important antibiotics to food-producing animals for non-therapeutic purposes. It specifies that medically important antibiotics must be provided to the smallest number of food-producing animals necessary. It requires the livestock producer that operates a concentrated animal feeding operation to file an annual report if any medically important antibiotics were provided to food-producing animals It requires the Oregon Health Authority to consult with the Oregon Department of Agriculture to adopt rules and declares emergency effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment which removes the section to bring action in circuit court in Marion County. There is no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but statements have not yet been issued.
Okay. Anthony Gasco is my legislative assistant. He's the one with the biology degree, and I said, this is yours, Anthony. And so he is provided a brief statement. So please proceed.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Gaskill. I am a staff member with Senator Montes Anderson, who is the chair of this committee. I'm here today to give a brief statement on behalf of her office regarding Senate Bill 920 and just touch upon the bill's importance as well as its intent. Medical authorities in the U.S. warn that antibiotics are in danger of losing their potency due to antibiotic resistance. The cause of this resistance has been linked to the overuse of the antibiotics themselves. When used frequently, antibiotics are shown to select for resistant bacteria. While the overuse and misuse of antibiotics does indeed occur among humans, it is oftentimes seen with food-producing animals as well, where 70% of medically important antibiotics being sold in the U.S. are used on food-producing livestock and poultry. Instead of just being used on animals that are sick, farm animals are often routinely fed subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics in their daily feed and water supply in order to make them grow bigger more quickly, but also as a form of disease prevention. However, these routine subtherapeutic practices breed antibiotic-resistant bacteria that can migrate into the human population, resulting in more prevalent and impervious bacterial infections that can cause further harm to the public's health. Senate Bill 920 would seek to prohibit all routine and subtherapeutic use of medically important antibiotics on swine, cattle, and poultry for purposes only relating to growth promotion, disease prevention, feed efficiency, and weight gain. Farmers would still be able to continue treating sick animals with antibiotics and have the ability to do some preventative measures in the event of an outbreak, but not on a routine basis. The bill also requires EPA to find concentrated animal feeding operations to submit an annual report itemizing all their medically important antibiotic use to the OHA. The state is not required to do anything other than design and collect these reports. Only the OHA and the Attorney General will have authority with regards to administration and enforcement. The Dash 1 amendment that has been submitted along with this bill would remove the citizen suit provision in Section 6. Members of the committee, I urge you to pass Senate Bill 90 with the Dash 1 amendment. The FDA's actions on this matter fall way too short to be effective in curbing resistance. Drug companies would only be required to stop selling antibiotics solely for the purpose of growth promotion, while continuing to allow all other routine subtherapeutic overuses. Antibiotic resistance is a public health issue that will one day have to be addressed, and it is crucial that it be addressed as soon as possible before a point is reached where antibiotics can no longer be used as effective medicine, and the cost to fix the problem would exceed what it would be today. Thank you.
Good work, Anthony. Thanks. Question for Anthony? Okay. Thank you very much. John Santa, Don Noel, or Nuet, and Brian Wong.
I was elected to go first. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Wong. I am Chief of Infectious Diseases Division of the Department of Medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University, where I'm also Professor of Medicine and of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology. I'm here on the part to testify on behalf of OHSU in support of Bill 920. The discovery of antibiotics and their use for treating infectious diseases is one of the greatest achievements in medical history. Many diseases that were often fatal can now be cured or controlled with antibiotics, including pneumococcal pneumonia, streptococcal and staphylococcal infections, infections of newborns and their mothers, diarrhea in infants, typhoid fever, tuberculosis, and others. But when microorganisms are exposed to antibiotics, rare drug-resistant bacteria are selected and can outgrow and replace their drug-susceptible counterparts. This resistance does not develop every time an antibiotic is used. Rather, resistance tends to develop only after antibiotics are given to large numbers of individuals over prolonged periods of time. There is now a broad consensus in the medical, scientific, and public health communities that the emergence of highly drug-resistant microorganisms is a major threat to human health. Some important drug-resistant organisms include methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, commonly known as MRSA, Clostridium difficile, commonly known as C. diff, drug-resistant strains of bacteria that cause gonorrhea and other sexually transmitted infections, multiply drug-resistant enteric bacteria, such as the carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, or CREs, and drug-resistant organisms that cause tuberculosis, malaria, and AIDS. The emergence of CREs and other organisms that are resistant to all available antibiotics has led to the suggestion that we may be entering a post-antibiotic era, which will resemble the period of history before we had antibiotics to treat common infectious diseases. In Oregon, MRSA, C. diff, and drug-resistant gonorrhea are significant problems, but we have so far experienced fewer cases of serious CRE infections and drug-resistant tuberculosis than many other states. What can we do to protect Oregonians from the post-antibiotic era? One strategy is to develop new antibiotics. Unfortunately, few new antibiotics have been developed in the past 20 years, and most large pharmaceutical firms have dropped their antibiotic discovery programs. Therefore, it is imperative that we do everything we can to preserve the usefulness of the antibiotics we already have. First, our healthcare institutions and we as healthcare providers must do our best to minimize the development of antimicrobial resistance. This entails establishing surveillance programs to detect and report resistant organisms, promptly instituting infection control measures when we find these organisms, and practicing careful stewardship of antibiotic usage. The state of Oregon and OHSU have invested heavily in surveillance for resistant organisms and also introducing modern antibiotic stewardship programs throughout the state. Large and small hospitals, nursing facilities, and clinical laboratories throughout Oregon have all participated in these efforts. In my opinion, one reason that we have fewer drug-resistant infections in Oregon than do people in many other states is that we use antibiotics more wisely than do practitioners elsewhere. Secondly, it is very important that we eliminate the use of antibiotics in animals for purposes other than treatment and prevention of infectious diseases. In this country, more antibiotics are given to animals than to people, and many of these antibiotics are given to promote weight gain or for prophylaxis in the absence of infection. Giving animals low doses of antibiotics increases antibiotic resistance in the bacteria circulating in the community, which increases the risk that humans will acquire antibiotic-resistant infections. Ending the practice of giving uninfected animals antibiotics has been recommended by the World Health Organization, the U.S. Public Health Service's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the White House, and professional societies such as the American Medical Association and the Infectious Diseases Society of America, among others. Giving antibiotics to healthy animals for non-therapeutic purposes has been forbidden in the European Union for many years, and the Food and Drug Administration has begun the process of regulating this practice in this country, but we should do what we can here in Oregon. OHSU joins the organizations listed above in recommending against the routine administration of antibiotics to animals for non-therapeutic purposes. We support Senate Bill 920 as a prudent step to protect the public health and to prevent development of antimicrobial resistant bacteria in Oregon. We should act now before it is too late. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Let's go through the panel first. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Santa. I'm a physician and a medical director at Consumer Reports. I'm here today on behalf of Consumers Union, the policy and action arm of Consumer Reports, and we're here to support Senate Bill 920. 920 will curb the overuse of medically important antibiotics in meat production. We believe it will help diminish the routine feeding of medically important antibiotics to healthy food animals. And that's what my focus will be in the remaining time that I have. You know, most of us think about antibiotics like this. I mean, we have trouble getting the top off. What we're talking about here is the routine feeding of tons of antibiotics to animals in Oregon, in their feed, in their water, in the environment. I was impressed, and I think most physicians and consumers would be impressed when you read the science of resistance, that what's carrying these resistant genes, these vehicles that carry it, they survive the death of the human or the death of the animal. They even survive the death of the bacteria. And they are there in the environment waiting to run into another bacteria and integrate themselves into its DNA. We all live in this huge soup, and we're pouring antibiotics into it. Again, Consumers Union estimates, based on FDA data, that close to 19 million pounds of antibiotics is introduced into the environment in the United States. Hard to get an estimate of Oregon. Hundreds of tons, probably. We know that doctors are increasingly alarmed by this trend. I think you're going to see that today. In a poll that we commissioned of primary care physicians across the country, one-third of doctors reported that they had had a patient who died of a resistant bacteria. One-third of physicians. So we're particularly focused on this subtherapeutic dosing of healthy animals in order to prevent disease, animals that if other husbandry practices were used wouldn't require this kind of approach to increase their survival and their weight. That's where the issue is, and the federal government hasn't addressed this adequately. We also support the annual report idea in order to start to get an idea. Like, we have lots of metrics, and Consumers Union is holding physicians responsible for performance metrics around decreasing antibiotic use. And it's time for the agriculture to join that, and this will be a first time, I think, a way of doing that. Thank you for hearing my testimony, and here to answer questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dawn Nolt. I'm a pediatric infectious disease doctor, and I'm within Dornbecker Children's Hospital. I have specialized in treating infections in children for over 15 years. I am the Oregon state expert in terms of dealing with infections in children with cancer, with inadequate immune system, and with cystic fibrosis, and I'm speaking in support of Senate Bill 920. Dr. Wong and Dr. Santana eloquently talked about all the issues. I just want to share three stories in the past 3 months that would give us a taste of what the post-antibiotic era looks like. So a pediatrician on the coast calls me. He asks for help for antibiotics on a four-month-old who has a urine infection. And to his surprise, the bacteria is resistant to everything that can be given by mouth. And so what that means is that this four-month-old who's otherwise healthy but has a simple UTI has to get transferred from the coast to our hospital at Dornbecker to get IV antibiotics for the next 10 days, which is quite horrific for that family. Another example is a mother who's very sick, who has to deliver her child at 6 months of 6 months gestation. So that baby's in our NICU for 4 days, hasn't received any antibiotics, and yet gets a very serious bacterial infection. And the last example is a teenage boy who was diagnosed with cancer, and during his chemotherapy, he comes down with an infection that lands him in the ICU. The cancer doesn't land him in the ICU, the infection does. And of the kids that I'm talking about, the baby, who is 4 days old, has an infection. There's only 5 antibiotics in the world that can treat that. There's 150 antibiotics in the world, and we can only use 5. And the teenager that's in the ICU, there's only 8 antibiotics in the world that can treat that. So I just want to emphasize that these are kids, 4 months, 4 years, 4 months, 4 days, and a teenager who has never seen antibiotics in their life, and yet they are suffering from resistant infections. And so this is due to an overuse of antibiotics in our community, but outside of the patients that are ultimately suffering from this. The second case I want to make is that as doctors and as other medical providers, we deal with something called the right dose, the right antibiotic, and the right disease. And what that means is that we are really trying to restrict antibiotics from being overused in low dose for prevention or non-medical reasons. What I tell my colleagues, and Dr. Wong can also agree, is preventive or non-medical use of antibiotics is really from anxiety, really trying to treat anxiety or to look to gain an infection, to gain an advantage. Antibiotics are not anti-anxiety medications. antibiotics are for infection, and we need to preserve our antibiotics for our very sick. So as a medical professional working with serious infections in kids, I need all the help I can get. And our community needs to reduce resistant bacteria. The removal of antibiotics being given to healthy animals will go a long way towards improving the health and preserving the future of our kids. Thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 920, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Question. Just really supportive of this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Richard, is it Karna Vowick, Tylen Braden, and Dr. Tom Keck?
Karna.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's okay. Okay, I guess I was designated to go first. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dr. Richard Carnevale. I'm a veterinarian and a vice president at the Animal Health Institute in Washington, D.C. The Animal Health Institute represents the manufacturers of animal health products for both food producing and companion animals. I have submitted a much more complete statement for the record. But in the short time I have today, I just want to highlight a few things of why I traveled across the country to talk to you. I was here about 2 weeks ago at the House Agriculture Committee hearing on H.R. 2598. I told that committee that there is an ongoing process by the FDA to change the way antibiotics are labeled and used in food-producing animals. However, within the last week, the President Obama has released a national action plan to implement a White House strategy called Combating Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria that was released last fall, called CARB. The action plan details, among other objectives for both human and animal medicine, the specific FDA plan to phase out growth promotion uses of medically important antibiotics and put veterinary controls over those products that are added to feed and water. And here's the action plan cover I brought along today. The plan is 63 pages long. I didn't reproduce the whole thing. I reproduced some of the pages that have to do with the animal portion, and we have submitted that for the record as well.
Thank you.
The plan has specific objectives, but most importantly, it has milestones and time frames for the completion of each objective. So while this was an FDA initiative, it is now a White House initiative, endorsed and being monitored by the administration, and agencies will be held accountable for implementing it. What does this mean? By the end of 2016, label indications for growth promotion will be removed from medically important antibiotics, and a label restriction will require a veterinarian's order before the antibiotic is used to prevent or control disease. There is no FDA definition of non-therapeutic or routine prevention. A veterinarian will now make the decision when the antibiotic is needed in his best medical judgment. Between now and then, the FDA will provide updates of the progress towards this goal, and they've already published some of those updates. The action plan also directs the United States Department of Agriculture to enhance its on-farm data collection to assess how antibiotics are being used for what species and for what purposes under the National Animal Health Monitoring System. This will supplement the already reported data on antibiotic sales that the FDA puts out every year. There has been some criticism that the FDA plan is voluntary. So while companies were initially asked to voluntarily comply, all the companies have now agreed in writing to FDA to change all product labels. I might add that some companies have already done this. I have been leading a team of pioneer and generic animal health companies over the last year that has worked with the FDA to develop an implementation plan to try and meet this 2006 timeframe. The companies are committed, and while this is a big job, we intend to get it done. Once the labels are changed, it will be illegal to use these antibiotics in feed and water in any way other than what the label says, and a veterinarian's order called a veterinary feed directive or a prescription to give them will be required. So my message is that the federal process is working, and will result in changes in the way antibiotics are used in all 50 states simultaneously. I would discourage this committee from moving forward with a bill that will put Oregon farmers and ranchers at a disadvantage until the federal program is fully implemented. The bill does not change product labels, only prevents Oregon farmers from using medications that are still FDA approved and legally marketed. I urge you to defeat 920 and rely on the federal process to take effect that for all practical purposes will meet the objectives of your bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairwoman Mona Sanderson, members of the Senate Health Committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Tyler Braden. I'm the operations manager for Beef Northwest, the largest cattle operation in the state of Oregon. I'd like to begin by noting that I am a father and a husband, and I care for my family as much as anyone does. And on a daily basis, I feed them the products that I produce, and I raise them in the environment in which we operate and that I influence. If I ever thought that there was any chance whatsoever that I was endangering them or anyone else's family, I would immediately alter our production practices. And I can assure you that Beef Northwest shares this commitment with me, as do I'm sure each of you on this committee here today. This commitment to food safety and the well-being of our society, our environment, and our communities is why the beef industry is adopting and Beef Northwest utilizes documented systems which prove process validation. And we deliberately structure the management of our operations in such a manner to reduce or mitigate the need for metaphylactic use of antibiotics. However, we also have a commitment to the well-being of each and every animal that is within our care. And when those animals' health risk dictates, we employ antibiotic treatments for that animal's best interest intended. And every antibiotic used is done so under the prescription and admission of a Oregon State licensed veterinarian, PhD nutritionist. And every antibiotic in veterinary medicine is stringently reviewed, approved, and regulated by the FDA, pursuant with the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The same statute, mind you, that governs the review and regulation of drugs used by our human counterparts. The FDA, in collaboration with the CDC and the USDA, established the National Antimicrobial Resistance Monitoring System, NARMS, in an effort to prospectively monitor the occurrence of antimicrobial resistance of zoonotic pathogens from human diagnostic specimens, retail meats, and food animals. The most current NARMS animal report shows a decrease in drug resistance for each of the four major proteins compared to the previous 15 years. This is scientific validation that the actions of those in animal production are commensurate with my commitment to the well-being of each and every person in our communities and our society, while simultaneously continuing to meet the growing demands of an exponentially growing population. Thus, rendering additional legislation, regulation, or governance repetitious and superfluous. Therefore, I urge the committee to reject Senate Bill 920. It will only encourage more bureaucracy and litigation without adding 1 ounce of additional protection for the family members that you and I both care for. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tom Keck. I'm a practicing veterinarian from Dallas, Oregon. I'm a past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, presently on the board of directors of said organization, and served 9 years on the Veterinary Medical Examining Board for the state of Oregon. I'm not going to go and read the testimony that we've presented to you in written form, but I'm going to hit the highlights. The major things that the OVMA sees is that right now, the FDA, CDC, USDA, under the guidance and direction of the White House right now, are working on this problem. And they're looking at the very thing that this is addressing. Is there antibiotic resistance in food animals that is going and passing to humans? The data is not there yet to point that that is actually happening. Most of this is hypothetical. Not been proved. So we have to remember that. Second thing is the CDC, FDA, and USDA is working on this complex problem, has actually been doing it since 1996. And these are the people that are most qualified to do it versus people in our state government here. We do not have the expertise that those organizations do back in Washington, D.C., or in Bethesda. Here, the federal government is having the people that are the professionals try to solve the problem and not the politicians. This is just a gathering of data. We have yet to find out what you're going to do with the data other than gather it. There is no action on the data. This is already being done and actions being taken on the federal level. What is going to be the cost of gathering this data in the private sector or in the government here? Is this now going to be a public record that can be used against specific farms? Don't know. Sadly to say, the elephant in the room is antibiotic resistance that has been brought by my colleagues on the human side today is really and truthfully, in the cases they note, a human problem. Antibiotic resistance, bacteria going from animals to humans, today, not one of them presented a case of that. I can present cases of antibiotic-resistant organisms going from humans to animals. I'm not advocating that we do something about the humans. But we must look at the data and look at it scientifically. If the state of Oregon really wants to do something for the public health of the people of the state of Oregon, one of the best things that you could do is to require at this time by statute that all antibiotics in this state be used by direct prescription of a licensed veterinarian. We have the training. We have the expertise. Right now, any of you can go to a feed store and buy several different antibiotics with no training, no guidance, and use them on your animals, or sad to say, as Boise State University pointed out several years ago, on your own children. These are things that you could address to help the public health at this time. I think that kind of goes over what we've got going on. The federal government is working on this. The Obama administration has made this a priority. Oregon would only be muddying the water, I believe, at this time. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you very much. Now, what I'm going to do now is, because I'd asked the proponents that I only wanted about eight people, and that's true. We only have eight people for the proponents, but we've got 20 for the opponents. And I didn't tell the opponents to only limit it. But what I'm going to do is limit you to 3 minutes apiece. Thank you, panel. 3 minutes apiece, and when you see the yellow light go on, it means you've got 30 seconds to go. All right? With that, I'd like to call up Dr. Rachel Fisher and Dr. Walt, is it Buell?
Yes.
And Kendra Cumbra. Okay, close.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I really thank you for this opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 920. My name is Rachel Fisher. I'm a medical physician. I'm also board certified by the American Board of Preventive Medicine with a specialty in occupational medicine and environmental medicine. I'm also trained in epidemiology and public health. I don't represent any industry or specific interest group. I represent my patients and the public health. So like the professionals before me said, who I cannot replicate their excellent testimony, I don't have their expertise, but I will say in medical school, I learned about judicious use of antibiotics. It's about using the right antibiotic at the right time and in the right way. And so a few years ago when I learned about the use of antibiotics in food animals, I was a little bit shocked to say the least, and I've taken on this issue and have tried to speak about it whenever I can. As physicians, we are part of these antibiotic stewardship programs. But it seems like no matter
how well we execute the stewardship program, it's not going to be enough. It really isn't. Because when 70 to 80% of the antibiotics sold in the United States are used for food animals, we're up against a much bigger enemy here. And even with the new proposed federal legislation, it's not going far enough. And while that can be commended in that it would not allow the use of antibiotics for growth for growth of the animals, it could still be used for disease prevention. So I look at it this way. It's like putting a little sprinkle of antibiotics in your children's cereal every morning and sending them off to school in hopes that they don't get sick. We know as physicians that's a completely inappropriate way to be using antibiotics. We know that bacteria are very resilient, and they've survived for millennia. They've been around much longer than we have. And I look at it this way from an epidemiological perspective if I'm looking at the environment. If there's hundreds and thousands of animals who are given subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics in their feed and water every day, these bacteria that are carrying these resistant genes outlive those without the resistance, and then they continue to multiply. They're then carried on by the farm workers into their families, inadvertently to their communities. I understand these are wonderful people, and they're trying to do the right thing. But what's happening is that these antibiotic-resistant bacteria are being spread into our farmlands because the waste from the animals are being used to fertilize crops. These are then being, of course, spread out to and sold directly to markets for packaged and food production. And I will say this, last thing I'm going to say, it is well, I would say, proven that there is a definitive link between routine use of non-therapeutic or routine non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in food animal production and antibiotic resistance in humans. I went through the data myself. There are study after study after study, and we're able to genetically link them. So there is proof. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
And for those of you who can't give orally your testimony, you can send it to the committee administrator or to the committee, and we'll have it posted. Thank you. And I made a mistake. It was 20 proponents and 8 opponents, so I made a mistake. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Ms. Anderson, and members of the committee. My name is Walt Buell. I've been 43 years practicing and delivering care, primary care, in the state of Oregon, first in Fossil. Then I moved to the Dalles for 12 years, and now I'm in Milwaukee and Oregon City. I'm not going to repeat what I have already presented and said in to you. The principles behind this bill are not new. At least 3 decades ago, I was hearing about and learning about how to avoid resistance in bacteria from emerging. Likewise, the consensus is very clear. The number of supporters on the national front to avoid this kind of drug resistance emergence is a very long list, and you will have it in front of you with my other materials. The more we expose germs to antibiotics, the greater the chance of an emergence of a resistant strain developing. This is a statistical game that we are playing, that we are already losing. We can't continue on the same course. The germs will win. The post-antibiotic world is impossible to envision because none of us is old enough to remember the pre-antibiotic world. But it isn't going to be pretty, and it means that treatments of fairly common standard illnesses will have to resort to the old techniques, which usually involve surgery, long hospital stays, and if anybody has noticed, the newer antibiotics are all extremely expensive. And I'm not certain that the economy can bear this kind of load. We already know we can't bear what we're doing now. Once again, the FDA plan that has been quoted is
not surprising for those of us on the front lines, is too little and it's too late. They have been struggling with this for a long time, and it's an opportunity for the state of Oregon to step out and take leadership with this kind of approach towards combating this very risky behavior. I have given you a scenario in my printed material that you can certainly look at. I won't repeat that. But Senate Bill 920 begins the work of avoiding the grim scenarios that you've already heard about, and I ask for your thoughtful and principled consideration of the facts of the bill and the principles of the bill. Your decision to move this bill forward can only positively affect all of us. Thank you very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to testify. My name is Kendra Kimbaroskis, and I'm here today because I'm a producer. I live in Linn County, and I produce pastured hogs and pastured poultry. My very first job growing up was milking cows on my family's dairy farm, and I come from a long generation of family farmers. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 920. I think it's smart, it's reasonable. Those that you've heard from today in the medical industry are doing their part to be more judicious with our medically important antibiotics, and I believe agriculture should be held to the same regards. Not only are antibiotics used for growth promotants in healthy animals, but they're used as a replacement for good animal husbandry. And I just brought a couple of pictures because I think this is important to see. In the large confinement operations, animals are housed inside and basically live their entire lives without ever feeling the sun on their back or the earth under their feet. And they're often housed with their own fecal matter. It's a very unhealthy condition. And so routine dosages of antibiotics are required in order to keep these animals alive and get them to market. This is an example of a broiler house. And this is an example of a hog house. These animals, again, are housed confined on cement in their own feces. It's not a healthy place. The contrary are producers who raise their animals outside. And this is actually a picture of my farm. These are my hogs on my 70 acres in Linn County. And these are my broiler chickens on my 70 acres in Linn County. So without taking up too much time, I think there is a better way. We as producers need to be doing our part. Good animal husbandry makes up for the need for routine antibiotics, and I urge your support of Senate Bill 920. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Comments? No, thank you very much for coming. Louis Kazmaier, Dr. Jeff Windler, and Bill Matus?
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the Senate Health Care Committee. My name is Jeff Wendler. I'm the Northwest Livestock Manager for Three Mile Canyon Farm, a leading produce and dairy farm located near Boardman, Oregon. I'm a licensed veterinarian and currently serve on a national panel focusing on animal welfare. The proper care and treatment of our herd is my professional life's work and my passion. At Three Mile Canyon Farm, we milk approximately 30% of Oregon's dairy cows. I'm proud to say that under my care and the care of 5 full-time veterinarians, 2 consulting veterinarians, and 1 full-time PhD nutritionist, our lactating herd has been antibiotic-free for the past 4 years. So while I agree with and applaud this committee's concern for animal welfare and the public issue raised by the misuse of certain drugs in the treatment of livestock, I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 920. Because by its terms, Senate Bill 920 will not ensure any additional protection for animal welfare, the public health, or consumers. Senate Bill 920 will create excess bureaucracy and a litigation machine that will be a detriment to Oregon farmers, cattle, and consumers. The flaws of Senate Bill 920 are obvious. It creates a duplicative and wasteful regulatory scheme already addressed by federal agency with clear expertise in this area, the FDA. The significant issues raised in Senate Bill 920 have already been considered and will be fully addressed by the Veterinary Feed Directive to be implemented in 2016. Section 4 and Section 6 are tailor-made for increased litigation, not improved animal welfare. For the person caring for a herd, what guidance is found in the term shortest duration necessary or smallest number of food-producing animals necessary? Why create a right of action for persons aggrieved by a violation without defining what that means? And then bankrolling the aggrieved suing party but not penalizing a lawsuit brought to harass and cause mischief. Let me repeat that I take the issues of animal welfare and public health very seriously. At Three Mile Canyon Farm applies our values in a robust and intentional way to implement programs and protocols to protect our animals, the public, and our customers. I've attached a copy of our protocols for antibiotic use to this testimony. Let me mention a few highlights of our animal welfare program. We have an animal welfare committee which meets monthly, made up of management and union members of the United Farm Workers who work at our dairy operation. We engage an independent consultant from Evergreen College as our animal welfare advocate to represent our animals as we develop animal welfare protocols and training procedures, and incorporating emerging research into our operations. We retain an independent third-party auditor with national credentials, Validus, to quarterly visit and grade us on standards that have been established for best practices in the nation. In conclusion, you should demand that Oregon be a leader in animal welfare and public health issues. I am here to tell you that you don't need Senate Bill 920 to achieve that goal, and ask you respectfully to reject Senate Bill 920 and work even more closely with the Oregon agriculture community that shares your values and is committed to optimizing herd health, public safety, and consumer protection. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Anderson, my name is Louis Casimir, and I'm the owner of Rick Rial Dairy. And I'm kind of in the trenches as far as doing this work ourselves and keeping track of our animal husbandry practices and having a committee. We are a family farm. We've recently instituted on Rick Rial Dairy a program called RX Plus. And it sets up protocols and gives us exactly what the withdrawal times are for antibiotics that we have to use when we get a sick animal. Our animal husbandry protocols have been overseen by our vet and are set up to keep the milk and the beef that we produce 100% safe. Every load of every pound of milk, a representation of that milk is tested for antibiotics before it leaves my farm. It's tested again when it gets to the processor. And if there's even a question, they test it again. In 15 years, I don't think we've ever had a what we call a hot tank of milk where we had a mistake and antibiotics went into the milk. We have never had a tank leave our property with antibiotics in it. Our animals that go to beef are taken apart by USDA. Samples are taken of the animals to test for antibiotics. If there is one of my animals that goes in that tests positive to antibiotics, they will shut me down. The rules are already in place. So I'm speaking, just try to imagine the workload that this is going to add on the small family farms, keeping track of this. We've already got vets in place. We've got the paperwork involved, and we're doing a really good job of it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. I'm Bill Mattis, and I'm the president of the Northwest Chicken Council and also the California Poultry Federation. My background is in newspapers. I was the chairman of the National Newspaper Association before I started this job 20 years ago. And they brought me on board to actually work with consumers to show why the West Coast chicken is better than anywhere else. And we've done that over the years. We basically came up with a new fresh standard nationally. We fought the national organizations to come up with what freshness meant in the West, and everyone else now has to follow it because we changed the rule at the USDA. We also had the first organic chicken. It came out of California. It's now owned by Draper Valley and Petaluma, that's up here in the Northwest as well. And as of May, Oregon, Washington, and California will have more antibiotic-free and organic chickens than anywhere else in the United States. Well, our biggest company, Foster Farms, is turning antibiotic-free with most of their product and also a lot of organic. So there's a lot of changes coming down the pike because of this FDA regulation, which we worked with very closely. And we're very serious about using less antibiotics. They are no longer used for growth promotant, period. We do not use them for that. We do not use them, as was mentioned earlier, for prescription medicine because our barns are clean. And I can show you pictures of barns as well, although I didn't bring any with me today. But we do not use medications in the feed, in the water, to prevent diseases. When there is a disease, we do put medications into the feed to treat that barn. That's what happens. And before the birds are moved to processing, they are also taken samples of their livers so that no antibiotics are left in those birds before they're actually processed. We are in the West, consumers tell us a lot about what they want. It's a lot different than the rest of the nation. And so we've done a lot of different things. Our plants are all unionized now. We have UFCW runs our plants indoors, and we actually deal with unions, and they work with us very closely. We also are the members of the American Humane Association, the only large companies who actually belong to that animal welfare organization out of Washington, D.C. We are committed to use less and less antibiotics, but the biggest problem with the legislation and your legislation here is the fact is 30% of your chickens that you consume here in Oregon are not from Oregon. And so if you pass the law for our companies, which we still are antibiotic free and we will be, you're going to be eating chicken and your consumers are going to think that their chicken that they're eating from out of state is also antibiotic free and you have no jurisdiction over that chicken. So that's the really the biggest problems we see is that consumers are going to be misled into thinking all the chicken they eat here in Oregon is antibiotic free chicken when in reality it will not be. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your testimony. Thank you.
Read it. Something Rivera from Douglas, Mary maybe, and then Michael Gubert and Jen Zametti.
Please proceed.
Hi. Madam Chairman, my name is Dr. Mary Herrera. I'm a mixed animal practitioner from Douglas County, Oregon. And I'm here in support of this bill today. I'm also a member of the AVMA, of the OVMA, and I listened to the testimony earlier today, I'm not aware of any polling done by members of the OVMA on this committee, so I'd like to somewhat refute the notion that we're all monolithic against this bill, because I have friends of mine that I've spoken to that are definitely very concerned about this area of antibiotic resistance. In our practices, we all see this on a daily basis. I just attended a large veterinary conference in Vegas, and the concern with many of the dermatologists that day was, how are we going to manage some of these resistant bacterial infections that we're seeing in dogs and cats, because we're losing our antibiotics in veterinary medicine as well. So it's a real concern. The bacteria are they're prolific, they're dangerous, they're common. And we're not seeing, as they spoke earlier today, there hasn't been a new antibiotic family or a line of antibiotics that's really been brought to the market since 1987. So it's a concern for us as veterinarians. I deal with family farms. Most of my practice is a companion animal. I do a fair amount of work with backyard poultry, and I can tell you that it's very difficult to find feed that does not contain antibiotics in it. I went out with my mom to our local co-op and was just trying to find some Chickstarter and couldn't find anything. She's a vegan and very concerned about this. And we looked and looked and looked and finally had to end up getting feed that had antibiotics with it. So it is a concern. And there are some excellent livestock producers that have spoken today. Our concern isn't with them. It's with a lot of people that take the shortcuts, that have animals that are being raised in really dirty surroundings, unsanitary surroundings, that are taking the easy way out, feeding, and hoping that it'll get them by. So thank you.
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Michael Giebert, and I'm a farmer out in Corbett, Oregon, which is in far eastern Multnomah County. We raise dairy cows, chickens, pigs, turkeys, and goats. And I'm also the board chair for the East Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District, though I'm speaking here today strictly on behalf of myself and not the district. I kind of want to talk about a couple quick points. So one, you heard earlier that antibiotic resistance is strictly a human issue, and that's not true. The CDC issued a report that identified 18 emerging antibiotic-resistant threats, and while only two of them were related to ag, I mean, there were two. So there was Salmonella and Campylobacter are related to agriculture. And in Campylobacter, we're already seeing a 25% of cases that are resistant to antibiotics. And that's an issue that's coming from agriculture. And I also want to share a little cautionary tale that's not strictly related to antibiotics, but it's the same process. So like I mentioned, I raise goats. And goats have a high propensity for intestinal parasites, and there's four classes of wormers that can treat parasites in goats. And the traditional veterinary recommendation was to worm on a regular schedule and even alternate different types of wormers. And what this did, which is the same process that's being used in antibiotics, is to build up resistance. So there's some parts of the country that there are no wormers that work for goats right now. And I mean, and we're seeing that spread across the country, and even here in Oregon, we're seeing some wormers that are just not effective for goats. And that same process is already being documented with antibiotics, and it's an issue that we need to take seriously. I raise my animals in a way that promotes health. I raise all my animals on pasture. My animals are generally very healthy, but things happen. And when I have an animal that gets sick, I want to be able to treat it. And I want to have a medicine that works. But if we don't have antibiotics, I mean, we're going to have more and more sick animals, but we're also going to have that crossover into people. And it just doubles the importance of the issue. So as a farmer in Oregon, I urge your support for Senate Bill 920. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Zimetti. I'm a resident of Grants Pass. I don't know anything about the science or the farming with this issue, but I have a personal story to share. This past February, my 13-month-old, or then 13-month-old granddaughter nearly died from a urinary tract infection. She had, and it was an E. coli infection. It was antibiotic resistant. We didn't know this at first. Her primary care provided a 10-day antibiotic dose when she diagnosed the UTI. She'd never been sick before, so this was her first antibiotic dose ever. At the end of the 10 days, my daughter had noticed that the baby had improved slightly, but not as much as you would have expected with a urinary tract infection and 10 days of antibiotics. Two or three days later, she had declined so rapidly and so badly that she was having febrile seizures because her fevers were shooting so high. She went to the emergency room at Three Rivers Hospital in Grants Pass, where they detected that she still had that urinary tract infection. They did a clean catch urine sample with the catheter. And I think they began at Three Rivers the process of culturing the bacteria. In the meantime, they double dosed her on antibiotics, two different kinds, that are primarily intended, I think, for meningitis, because that was sort of worst case scenario while they were waiting for the tests, but they also should have worked on a UTI. She did not get any better. She was dehydrated. Her potassium levels had dropped so low that her heart health was at risk. She was 13 months old and not crying anymore. She was, I'm sorry, right away. She was so sick. It was very scary. I've never been a very reactive or overreactive parent or grandparent for that matter, and when it was happening, I wasn't doing this, so I'm sorry that I'm doing it now. The doctors at Three Rivers called Dornbecker's and were in communication and conference with Dornbecker's staff, and it was decided that she should be transported up to Dornbecker's so that we could figure out what was going on. They took her just shy of 350 miles from our town up to Dornbecker's, where they admitted her there after having been admitted for 3 days with no improvement in Grants Pass. Dornbecker's, in cooperation with Three Rivers Lab, had cultured the bacteria and found that it was reactive to one bacteria, to one antibiotic. They then switched up the antibiotics, gave her the one that reacted in the petri dishes, and in 3 or 4 days, we saw improvement. When she was in Grants Pass, she was so sick that they had to drill a hole in her calf bone to put in an interosseous infusion, which is like an IV, only it's directly into the bone marrow, mm-hmm. because they couldn't find a vein because she was so dehydrated. So I support this bill because I never before thought about how antibiotic-resistant bacteria, how it functions, why it works, how we're at risk for it until this happened to my grandchild. And I think that the trauma that it was for her family, you should do what you can to avoid that for other families.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Ian Tolleson, Jerome Rosa, and Mark Silva.
Good afternoon, Senator Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Jerome Rosa, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We have approximately 2,000 members in the state, and cattle industry is Oregon's largest agricultural industry, now at over $1 billion a year. We can all agree that healthy animals are the basis of a healthy and humane and safe food supply. Farmers and ranchers use a variety of tools, including vaccines, good nutrition programs, and proper housing to keep animals healthy. Antibiotics are only one tool in a plan of good production practices to raise healthy farm animals. Farmers, ranchers, and veterinarians are required by law to follow the Food and Drug Administration rules and see that the drug is appropriately and correctly used. There are regulatory safeguards in place to ensure labels are being followed. FDA approves antibiotics and the specific dosage rates to treat specific diseases or conditions, and producers are legally required to follow these precise label directions. This legal approval process was more stringent in 2003 when FDA finalized an additional safety measure requiring an antibiotic-resistant assessment for all new and existing antibiotics. The beef community is invested in quality assurance programs, research, and education designed to maintain high standards of animal care and health and help us continually improve how we use antibiotics. The livestock community, including farmers, ranchers, veterinarians, the federal government, and the animal health companies that make antibiotics proactively, are working together to continuously improve the way we respond and use antibiotics in livestock. Guidance 209 and 213 will eliminate growth promotion use of medically important antibiotics and extend veterinary oversight. Within about 3 years, any medically important antibiotics used in animals will be only for therapeutic purposes and under the supervision of a veterinarian. On March 26th, the Food and Drug Administration announced that animal health companies took the next step in this process by volunteering to agreeing to phase out the use of antibiotics for growth promotion in animals. The companies will either withdraw these antibiotics from use in animals completely or only will allow them to be used under a veterinary's prescription. There are many misconceptions and inaccuracies about antibiotic use in livestock. Not all antibiotics are used for all purposes. Different antibiotics are used to treat different bacteria in animals and humans. About one-third of the antibiotics used on farms aren't used in human medicine at all, meaning if resistance to these drugs did develop, it will have little impact on public health. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the diseases caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria with the most impact on human health are spread by human-to-human contact, such as through healthcare settings. For example, human MRSA strains responsible for the majority of human MRSA cases in hospital and community settings, but they are not related to livestock. To date, no clinical case of MRSA in a human related to livestock has been identified in the United States. All drugs used in food animals are extensively tested and monitored, and each new product must go through dozens of studies before being approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Chairwoman Anderson and committee members. My name is Mark Silva. Today I represent the Oregon Feed and Grain Association of Oregon, and we appreciate the opportunity to provide our position on Senate Bill 920 being heard today. The OFGA was established in 1939 here in Oregon to further legitimate the interest of the feed, seed, grain, and fertilizer industry. We are feed manufacturers, grain traders, seed cleaners, some fertilizer manufacturers, and some allied industries. I'm a non-paid board member on the board. I volunteer my time. Actually, I'm on vacation this week, but I volunteered to come and testify today. Our goal is to provide high quality and safe livestock feed. Is the goal of all of our members of OFGA, and we just want to reiterate that we are opposed to the bill, Senate Bill 920, as we believe that these regulations, the regulations of these products, are best handled by our federal government. So we have uniformity of the regulation across all of the U.S., and we encourage you to oppose this bill in its current form. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Tullis, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for Northwest Food Processors Association. We are opposed to Senate Bill 920. I'll just say that the citizens' lawsuit provision is something that we feel is very problematic and damaging to our member companies. And I would also add that it is important that this is regulated at the federal level. Our members that produce shell eggs or dairy products, for example, we operate in multiple states. Having one set of regulations for the state of Oregon will not have any impact on the food products that are produced in another state. You will not be able to impact those imported products, and they will have really a competitive disadvantage for our producers here in Oregon, while the producers outside of Oregon will have another set of standards. This is why it is best dealt with at the federal level. The FDA is going through their process right now to implement new labeling standards. Labeling is very important in our industry. You know, if anything is improperly used, there are ramifications for that, and our livelihoods are on the line. In light of this, we feel this bill is unnecessary and urge your opposition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No comments, but thank you. Rachel Kornstein, Andy Harris, and Dave Rosenfeld.
Hi. I'm a farmer 40 minutes south of Portland on a diversified farm. Rachel Kornstein. I couldn't be more in support of this bill. I've dedicated my future to farming because I believe in a healthy, sustainable future for our food community, our environment, and our children. And I believe that Routine use of antibiotics is harmful, obviously, to our health, the environment's health, but it, in my world in farming, it's a challenge looking towards the future. I believe in animals being raised outside in a balanced environment, indoors, poses challenges that is not, it's not a sustainable future for our food system. So I'm here in support of a different way of farming, and a hopeful future for sustainable agriculture.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Andy Harris. I'm a physician and assistant professor at OHSU, where I direct the Global Health Center. The majority of antibiotics dispensed in this country are used in animal agriculture, not to treat infections in people. In fact, 70 to 80% of the antibiotics are used non-therapeutically in livestock to promote growth and prevent disease due to crowded, often unsanitary conditions. Strong science documents the link between subtherapeutic use of antibiotics in animals and antibiotic resistance in infections, in human infections. Routine dispensing of antibiotics to livestock, especially when used over long durations, selects for drug-resistant strains of bacteria, sometimes known as superbugs, which kill 23,000 Americans a year. Longer, more expensive hospital stays for treating antibiotic-resistant bacteria cost the U.S. healthcare sector an estimated $21 billion to $34 billion annually, and an additional 8 million hospital days per year to treat those infections. For decades, physicians have been trained to prescribe antibiotics only for specific infections in humans, not to overprescribe and not to treat viral conditions like the common cold or traveler's diarrhea. Barry Estabrook wrote in Friday's New York Times that Danish farmers have raised pigs without relying on regular doses of antibiotics since the year 2000. I hear from testimony from farmers today that that's also being done in Oregon. This practice has not adversely impacted the income of Danish hog farmers or their competition on the world market. In fact, Danish farmers support this policy because it reduces antibiotic resistance in their herds. We've ignored this critical issue for far too long. Unfortunately, the Congress of the United States is in a state of paralysis, and it is time for the Oregon legislature to take decisive action before these life-saving antibiotics are no longer effective. We just don't need more studies. The policies outlined here are backed by the WHO, the CDC, the American Public Health Association, the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science, the American Nurses Association, the OMA, OHSU, and countless other medical organizations. I would urge you to support SB 920 to help save human lives. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, Executive Director of OSPIRG, the Consumer Group. There's very little I can add that hasn't already been said, so all I will say is that I'd like to call attention to, on the third page of my written testimony, there is a hyperlink to a couple of snapshots of labels of antibiotics that are fed to animals, medically important antibiotics. And you'll notice there are three dosages/indications. There is one subtherapeutic, meaning low-level dosage intended for growth promotion. There's a second subtherapeutic dosage intended for disease prevention or disease control. And there is a third therapeutic, much higher kill-level dosage for treatment. It's that third indication is what is okay and what generally the medical community says you ought to do. The first two are really problematic because they're basically part of this routine low dosage level. What the federal government is going to do is make that first one go away, the one for growth promotion. That second one is going to stay. And so it doesn't matter The antibiotics are going to be under the oversight and supervision of a vet, although that's a good step forward, because still in this country we're going to be able to, under the federal law and including the Obama administration's announcement last week, be able to do low, routine, subtherapeutic dosages for everything other than growth promotion. And the industry itself has said that only 10 to 15% of the drugs are used for growth promotion, and they've said themselves that drug sales they don't expect to change as a result. So I think that's the best way, that label, those snapshots, is the best illustration of why the action at the federal level is utterly insufficient and why this bill is absolutely necessary if we're serious to solve the problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. The final three, Ben Phelps, Ivan Maluski, and Mickey Clayton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Phelps. I'm an ER emergency room physician. I work in Eugene, Springfield at River Bend and Sacred Heart. Before that, I worked down in Klamath Falls. I'll be brief. I just wanted to kind of bring some perspective from the medical community on an everyday basis concerning antibiotic use and drug resistance to bacterial resistance to commonly used antibiotics. Just a couple things. Every day during the course of a shift at the emergency room, there's a period of time where somebody gives somebody else a stack of culture results, usually from urinary tract infections, skin infections, and blood cultures that have been shown that the antibiotics that were originally prescribed to treat those infections turned out to be resistant to that particular antibiotic, and we have to go back. Get a hold of those people, call them up, have them come back sometimes if it's a blood infection, but at least call them in the appropriate antibiotics. Sometimes it takes even a couple tries to get the right antibiotic. So it's something we deal with essentially every day is drug-resistant bacteria. Another just quick point is from the medical side of things, I spend a significant amount of my time treating humans, patients, and trying to educate them on whether or not they need antibiotics or not. We see a lot of people who come with the expectation that they're ill, they need antibiotics for sore throat, fever, cough, and in trying to be good stewards of those medicines, spend a lot of time counseling them that these are not things that they need to be treated for with antibiotics, just on our side of the perspective. I think most of the other things I had to say have been well articulated already, so
appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Mickey Clayton. I'm the owner operator of Dot Ranch. I raise poultry, beef, and sheep for meat and fiber in Scio, Oregon, Linn County. And I'm here to say the farmers don't have to fear SB 920. And I am a proponent of this bill because I think that these are things that good ranchers and good farmers are already doing. As far as the records keeping, if farmers aren't keeping track of their expenses, they're not going to stay afloat very long in the first place. So farmers and ranchers already know what we're dosing our animals with, how much we're purchasing, and we already have these records as a regular means of our business. Furthermore, it is very important to me as both a rancher and a mother and as somebody who has fought for our nation to ensure our safety both within and without our borders. And within our borders, that means ensuring the safety of our future as well as what we have going on today. In order to ensure the safety of our future and of our children and of our animals and the other things, we need to make sure that the medications that we rely on are actually going to use, are going to work for their intended purposes. The subtherapeutic use of antibiotics in the agricultural industry is in a lot of ways like shooting ourselves in the foot, because we're basically using up all of the tolerance that our animals have for this stuff, and we're breeding our own worst enemies. Waiting around for federal regulation isn't enough. Oregon has already stood at the forefront. Oregon has already been a leader in this country in a number of other areas. This is yet again a chance for Oregon to say, this is the pace we need to set, this is why we need to set it, and this is how it's going to work. As has already been brought up, the federal regulations are currently inadequate. While some people may say that this SB 920 isn't strong enough, as a farmer, I say it does everything it needs to do. It ensures that us farmers and ranchers are available and able to take care of illness in our animals as is appropriate, but it also ensures that we don't abuse that freedom. Thank you.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much for coming.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ivan Molusky with Friends of Family Farmers. We support this legislation. As an organization representing family-scale producers who use antibiotics responsibly, we believe that Senate Bill 920 is both a reasonable step and strikes the right balance to help prevent antibiotic misuse in large-scale animal confinement settings where it is most likely to occur, and to help prevent the development and spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Under Senate Bill 920, producers can continue to use antibiotics to treat sick animals, but would be appropriately prohibited from using medically important antibiotics for non-medical purposes such as growth promotion, weight gain, feed efficiency, and disease prevention in healthy groups of animals. However, it should be noted that Section 4 of the bill outlines circumstances where farmers may administer antibiotics more broadly when a disease or infection is present within a group of animals and antibiotics are needed to stop the spread of that outbreak. We believe this provision to be quite reasonable and allows responsible antibiotic use when it is appropriate, when is needed, when it is appropriate to treat medical issues. Now, some have argued that this is a federal matter. On other issues, I'm not sure that's the argument they make, but in this case, they do. However, the Food and Drug Administration has been way too slow to act on these issues, and there's a huge loophole in the federal rules, including the White House's proposal, and that loophole is around disease prevention. That's where the real issue here is. This bill allows for the treatment of animals when an actual disease outbreak is occurring. The federal rules allow for disease prevention on completely healthy animals by feeding them low doses of antibiotics, and that's become a massive loophole that some producers are already using and which will be continued by the federal current federal rules. And this issue is struck close to home. In a recent case linked to a company with Oregon operations in Oregon, antibiotic-resistant salmonella found on Foster Farms chicken sickened over 500 people in 27 states from May 2013 to July 2014. So this issue is on our doorstep, and Oregon can lead the way and really should be taking action on this issue through this bill. The last piece I'd like to touch on is with regard to larger-scale operations, Section 5 talks about a common-sense reporting system that would only apply to EPA-regulated concentrated animal feeding operations. These are the largest animal confinement operations that we have in Oregon. This simply requires an annual report from these operations to the state. I can guarantee you these operations are keeping these records already, so it will help us get a better track on what kind of antibiotics are being used, how they're being used, and how we can take steps in the future to prevent antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And lastly, I'd like to say that we do support the Dash 1 Amendment. We understand concerns have been raised around the citizen suit provision. The Dash 1 Amendment would take care of that issue, and we think that's an important way to make sure that those folks who have that concern have that addressed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call David up just to talk about the Dash 1 amendments, put on the record exactly what it does.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld with Osperg. And I should have said earlier, Osperg supports Senate Bill 920 with the Dash 1 amendment. What the Dash 1 amendment would simply do is remove Section 6 of the bill, which would create a private right of action for citizens. The Dash 1 amendment removes that private right of action and clarifies that the enforcement is in the hands of the state. And then it explicitly says that the OHA Health Authority could, if they choose to do so, but is not required to do so by rule, do further enforcement. So it just provides that authority to do so. And then implied, I believe, although I want to double check on this, so I'm just saying I will double check, implied is that, of course, the Attorney General could enforce the law as well. And the reason why that's why it's not in the Dash 1 amendment is because it's implied in Oregon law. But the private right of action is taken out completely.
Thank you. And the other concern I have, the opponents brought up a number of issues that I would love to discuss with you, but one is the labeling. Let's put it this way.
we can't require those out of state to do the labeling. Is that correct? Or
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct.
And so if the chicken, let's use chicken, comes in to the United States, it still can be sold, but it won't have a label, as the opponents have addressed.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The intent of this legislation is, or what we need to do, forget about the legislation, but what it is that we need to do is we need to stop the routine sub-therapeutic use of antibiotics on farms. It needs to stop happening because that's how we're breeding superbugs. And what the bill does is says we got to stop doing that. Now, that's really the beginning, middle, and end of it. Of course, we still exist in a national marketplace, and that national marketplace will operate however which way that marketplace is allowed to operate in other states. But if this bill passes, we can then have the assurance and peace of mind that on our farms here in Oregon, we're not breeding superbugs. We're not petri dishes. And that's what's important and why we're comfortable with the legislation as written, even if we're still going to have labels that are going to say this, that, and the other, because we, again, are in the United States of America and whatnot. So we're confident that what this does is the most important thing, which is stop here, us being petri dishes for superbugs.
And then the labeling piece, again, it would require them to label antibiotics if they're used, or this is, I'm just trying to see how we can differentiate with if we're requiring a certain kind of labeling,
Madam Chair, a label will still exist that in other states would allow one to give routine subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics to farm animals for disease control and disease prevention. Here in Oregon, however, you will not be able to do that if this bill passes, and that would be a good thing.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. It was a good hearing. Colleagues, we won't. Yes.
I'm slightly confused because what I heard from the industry in Oregon is we're already there. But if I'm going to take this logically, I would suggest that would also indicate that we shouldn't vaccinate kids for measles until there's an outbreak.
I wouldn't agree with that, but that's all right. All right, any other comments? Thank you, we won't have to meet on Friday. It doesn't look like, unless Wednesday really gets bad. If that were adjourned, bad. If that were adjourned.